Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest this morning is James J. Kaufman. He is an attorney, a successful businessman, and a former judge. Although James has published several works of nonfiction, this holiday season we will be entertained by his debut novel, The Collectibles. James and I will be discussing how his novel reveals the power of relationship, the nature of love, and ultimately the meaning of life. Good morning, Jim. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, Johnny, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here with you and your listeners.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed reading your novel. It is very well written. The story is wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little bit better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. First of all, I grew up in a rural upstate New York area in the Finger Lakes region, a tiny village that few have heard of, about 10,000 people. And my dad was a doctor there, and my mother his nurse. And it was a wonderful environment to grow up in. My dad's patients had no money, and early on, neither did we. Dad was paid in chickens, potatoes, corn, whatever. But my recollection is when patients came to the front door and asked for clothes that Doc had for them, I was instructed to go to the closet and give them what they needed. That was the kind of environment that I grew up in, and watching my dad practice medicine in all hours of the day and night. My mom was his nurse. And being supportive of him, that was the starting point, and the starting point of wonderful memories. I went to school there, played sports, listened to Bill Stern on the radio. TV at that time was just starting to come out. It was a new thing, if you could imagine. And did school, working on my paper route, picking up newspapers and batteries and taking them to the local junk dealer. That's how I earned my extra cash. And I went through that whole period, and finally my senior year, I bought my first Model A Ford, first car, which was a Model A Ford with a rumble seat, which I bought for $65. It was the pride of my existence at that time. I finished high school and went to college. This was in the mid-50s, 1956. And I worked during the summers and all during the time that I was in college, but enjoyed college greatly. Back then, fraternities were a big deal. And I developed lifelong relationships there that I'll never forget. In fact, actually, a little while ago, I attended my 50th reunion and met several of my fraternity brothers, all of whom have done very well, and it was wonderful to be with them. Johnny, I started out as a pre-med because my dad had in mind that I should be a doctor, and I thought he was such a wonderful man that that's what I ought to do. But when I got to college, I found out that medicine was really not, the nuts and bolts of medicine, if you will, were not what really interested me. I loved the bedside manner stuff, and I loved the dealing with the way he dealt with his patients. I used to go on rounds with my dad when I was a young boy and to the hospital, and I just marveled at how he related to his patients and how they loved him and how much he brought to them. And I watched my mom as a nurse do the same thing with her side of the equation, and as a nurse, how supportive she was with my dad. So there was a lot of heartfelt desire to be a doctor, but actually the chemistry and biology of it just didn't interest me. So I came back and in midpoint in college and sat down with my dad and said, "Dad, I'm not going to be a doctor." And he said, "Well, you know, you haven't earned the right to say that." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Well, because you haven't gotten straight A's." And how do you know whether you like biology or chemistry unless you get straight A's? Well, I surely wasn't getting straight A's. So I said, well, I'll tell you what, Dad. I'll go to summer school at the University of Buffalo Medical School, and I'll take organic chemistry 1 and 2 back-to-back. If I get 2 A's, do you think I could make this decision with your blessing? He said, sure, that's a deal. Figuring that would never happen. So I did that and got back-to-back A's, and then I talked to Dad, and he said, well, good luck. I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm sure with you. So I switched my major to psychology with a minor in religion, and then I finished college, had a wonderful time there, and I decided to go to law school. And then after law school, I worked in Washington, worked in New York City for a while. I felt that if I could make it in New York City, I could make it anywhere as a young guy, and I had that feeling, so I wanted to start out there. Didn't know a soul, didn't have any connections in the law, or any uncle to pave the way, or any of that. But my first job was for a defense carrier, insurance carrier firm in the Wall Street area. I was studying for the bar, so I was my first job was as a file clerk. One morning I showed up to do my filing, and the file manager gave me a file and said, would you take this over to city court and just ask the judge for an adjournment, a continuance? And I said, well, I can't do that. I mean, I'm not admitted. I'm not a lawyer yet. She says, no, it'll just be granted. Just go over and tell the judge that. I said, okay. I took the file, went over to court, and pretty soon the court judge called the case. I stood up and I said, Your Honor, I'd like to. And he said, Counselor, this case is ordered for trial at 2 p.m. I said, but Judge, he said, no buts, Counselor. This has gone on long enough. I'm ordering you to go to court at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And he banged his gavel. And you can go to room 407. So I went to room 407 and opened the file and looked at it for the first time. Pretty soon the plaintiff's lawyer showed up, and the judge walked in, and the jury was there, and we were ready to try the case. So, of course, I had not spent more than 4 or 5 minutes looking at the file, and no idea of what was going to happen. I listened to the plaintiff's lawyer try the case, and he had these little rubber cars that he used to describe the accident and how it happened and so forth. So I used those, and I cross-examined his witnesses and so forth, and we both stated whatever we could state. The case was finally over about 5:30, 6 o'clock, and I went back to the office. When I walked in, the senior partner was waiting for me with his brother, and he's also a partner, and they were obviously really upset. And they asked me, would you mind telling us where you've been? And I said, well, I've been in court. And he said, what do you mean you've been in court? It doesn't take 10 minutes to go to court and come back. And I said, no, well, actually, I was involved. I was ordered to try a case. Said, well, you can't try a case. You're not a lawyer yet. And it's impossible. And I said, well, I tried to tell the court that, but the court ordered me to try the case. He said, well, I just can't believe this. Do you have any idea what I'm going to tell the insurance company we represent that you've done this? And I said, well, you might tell them we won. And he said, you know, you're really a smart aleck. And I said, I don't think so, sir. I'm not trying to be a smart aleck. And he said, well, you can't. I just don't believe this. Who's the judge? And I told him. He picked up the phone. He called the judge. So, Judge, I've got a young man in front of me, and he's just told me a story that makes me want to fire him, but I just thought I'd check with you. And then he was interrupted by the judge, and he said, oh, really? Oh, really? Oh, yes, sir. Oh. And he said, thank you, Judge. And he hung up, and he said, the judge says I should be congratulated in having you in this firm. So that was my start. I suddenly wasn't a file clerk anymore. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I had an office then, and I passed the bar and went on to another firm in mm-hmm. Park Avenue, which was pretty exciting for me. I was 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was exciting, Johnny, but it was also I was very apprehensive about it. I couldn't believe that I was actually practicing law. And when I would mm-hmm. go by the entranceway to the building at 99 Park, and they had a directory, I'd look and see if my name was still there each morning. Because I thought it must be gone. Somebody's gonna say, okay, stop pretending.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I did that, and then eventually had a quite soon after that, actually, had an opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. And work in the House of Representatives. And that was also just a fortuitous event. I did some campaigning for a minority councilman, city councilman.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Lindsay decided to run for mayor and give up his congressional seat mm-hmm. at that time. And what happened is the minority councilman was going to be a sacrificial lamb, they called it at that time, against Orrin Lehman. Well, he put together a campaign, and a friend of mine and I helped him with that, and then by accident he won. And he had 600 by 600 votes or so. And so he invited me to come to Washington and be his legal aide, and he needed a legislative aide, and he needed a legal counsel and an administrative aide, three different mm-hmm. positions. And a friend of mine, who was really much more responsible for his election than I was, had the chance to go down there. And he said, no, I'll stay in New York. Jim should go. He'll fill all three positions. And so I did. So then, anyway, without going into all this detail too much. I would just say that if we finished up there, that's where I was. That's where my wife and I were married in Georgetown, and tell you about that a little later.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful event and a huge part of my life, obviously. Then I came back to Rochester, continued to practice after a while, and then finally came to North Carolina, and then went into several other aspects of my life, including boating with Riviera mm-hmm. Yacht mm-hmm. and all of that, and here I am today.
Fantastic. You are an attorney, a former judge, and a successful businessman. At what point in your life did you become interested in writing fiction?
Well, that happened, I think, the idea started quite early just because of the stories that I heard with my family when I was a young man, and mm-hmm. also the stories that I heard in real life before me in all my experiences with practicing law and the 14 years on the bench. And these stories were dynamic, Johnny, and they were real. And mm-hmm. and so the interaction with those stories and the reality of those stories and how human beings' lives were affected and impacted just seemed very real to me. And there just came to a point where I knew I wanted to write a novel because I wanted to bring these experiences to life. I wanted to have the freedom to create the characters that could blend so many of the characteristics and ups and downs and darkness and brightness and various people that I had observed along the way.
Very interesting. And what inspired you to write The Collectibles? And what does it really mean, The Collectibles?
Well, for me, The Collectibles at core is a way of approaching life. It's a philosophy, a principle, or a belief. My idea in writing The Collectibles was to put in words what had been in my mind and heart, hopefully my deeds, throughout my life.
Mm-hmm.
My sense of it is that there are many things in life, whether we like it or not, we can't control, or at least I can't. We can't stop the oil gushing out of the Gulf. Can't stop fighting in Afghanistan, or I can't. Can't stop the corporate mentality which values economic return above life itself in some cases. But I can, and I have over the years, helped a few people deal with issues in their lives. And we all need help in one way or another. So the idea for The Collectibles came to my mind because when I look at collections, people collect all kinds of things, as you know. I do too. I collect boxes and Civil War bullet molds. Some people collect watches, clocks, whatever, furniture, cars. But my idea for the collectibles was to suggest the same level of intensity could be employed to help one another. Success today is too often viewed in terms of wealth. I mean, we focus on net worth and the bottom line, but what does that say for all those people in the world that don't have a large net worth or any net worth? And does that mean these people aren't successful? I mean, I've represented a lot of millionaires over the years, and in some cases I've represented people that don't have a nickel, and I've enjoyed each one equally. Because when you look in the faces of the latter, you see a peace sometimes not present in people that are struggling with the burden of having millions. So the answer is what are the inherently good qualities that can be recognized in the characters of my story? How are their lives enriched and in the process of reaching out to them, enrich themselves? That's an appreciation of the investment. That's the appreciation of the investment of the collectibles.
I see. You used the quote from Montagne to set up your story. Why did you do that?
Well, there's several things about Montagne that have always interested me. I mean, I guess in particular his essay on friendship, the fact that he talks about in the friendship he speaks of one could give to the other would be the one who received the benefit who would oblige his friend. That quote, first of all, I think it fits a lot of the underlying core beliefs that are expressed in one form or another in this book. What I think about practically, what I thought about specifically, I remember a time when I took a friend of mine who was an accountant to a client of mine who was a farmer to introduce the accountant to the farmer because the farmer had asked me to see if I could find him somebody that could represent him. When I took the accountant out to the farmer's home, it was 8:30 at night. And farmers in the region where I grew up and probably across the country know a lot about getting up early, and they work very hard, and there's a long day, and then at night they wash up and they have their dinner and they complete the end of their day. But it's you don't visit a farmer at 2 in the afternoon, and I didn't want to ask these people to come to my office either because I know how hard they work. So I brought this accountant with me. We walked in, and the first thing that happened was the farmer's wife came over to me and gave me a big hug, and she said, "Jimmy, you're going to have some of my apple pie." And I said, before I could get the words out, the accountant said, "No, I'm sorry, man, we don't have time for that." And I said, "No, actually, we've got all the time in the world for that. Of course I'm going to have some apple pie." And we sat down, we had the apple pie, and we talked, and then we had just a good conversation and so forth. And finally, about an hour and a half later, I took the accountant and drove home. And he said to me, "Jim, why did you mess that up? I wanted an opportunity to meet these people. I wanted an opportunity to let them know all I know about accounting." And I said, you really need to understand a couple of things if you want to have these people want you to represent them. You have to understand, first of all, that you have to give them the opportunity to give to you. And second of all, you've got to have them get to know you as a person long before whether they care whether you're doing the right columns as an accountant, your tax.
Right.
It's about trust, and it's about relationship. So take a deep breath. I'm sure they'll be calling you. The main thing was you needed to eat some apple pie.
Well, he does not understand that it's not for him to show his resume. It's actually what they're looking for is someone real, someone they can trust. And you're
absolutely
correct about that.
Absolutely.
How much of the real Jim is in the novel?
Well, a lot. In the sense that I've drawn upon my experiences in life and then tried to relate those experiences directly to the characters. So in that sense, I'm in there, not in the sense of the characters themselves, but when the areas that that the characters become involved in.
Mm-hmm.
The camping, the mountains, the boating, all the collectibles, the challenges they face. Those are all very real to me. And I've lived a lot of those experiences. I mean, as a young boy, 6 or 7, I camped in the mountains and I fished in the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I was 8, I built my first boat on Canandaigua Lake. And I spent many summers fishing and hiking through Canada. When I was in law school, I worked during the summers as a counselor and a guide in the Adirondack Mountains, leading canoe trips through the chain of lakes and through the wilderness. So the settings in the book, the people involved, the characters and what they're doing and have done and the challenges they face in life, those are all things that I wrote about because I know something about them. But the characters themselves are made up. They're all a combination of many attributes of many of these people.
The essence of the collectibles is relationships, and I can see lots of it, personal as well as professional. How has your personal and professional relationships influenced your writing?
Well, again, I think on the business side and time on the bench, all had a direct influence on my writing. I mean, when I think about times on the bench, the things that pop into my mind are, for example, one time a woman who had charged her husband with assault and battery and knocked her around and abused her came up to the bench and said, "Your Honor, I'd like to withdraw my complaint." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, I made a mistake filing the complaint, and I just want to drop it."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Let me ask you a question." I said, "You're free to do that, but let me ask you a question. Is your husband in this courtroom?" She said, no, he's not here." I said, "Well, is he outside the courtroom?" She said, "Well, yes, he is." So I asked the trooper, "Would you go out and bring in the so-and-so, bring him up to the bench?" So the trooper goes out and brings this man up in front of me, and he takes a look at his wife. And I said, "I brought you here because your wife, this is your wife, right?" "Yes." "I brought you here because your wife is going to withdraw her complaint against you." And he said, "Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's fine."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Yeah, well, I just wanted to know how you feel about it, because we'll have to now examine your wife as to whether she should be have charges brought against her for perjury."
Mm-hmm.
And the woman said, looked at him and said, "You never told me that was going to happen." So he said, "Well, you know, I didn't know." And so she said, "Well, Judge, I don't want to be charged with perjury." And I said, "Well, are the allegations in this complaint true or not true?"
Mm-hmm.
She said, they're true." And I said, "Do you still want to withdraw the complaint?" She said, "No, I don't." And I said, "Well, we'll see to it that you get protection." And the husband spent that night and a few others in jail. but the point is that from the bench, and in my real life experiences, unfortunately, I've seen too much of spouse abuse. I've seen too much of husbands that knock their wives around, and even some cases, wives that knock their husbands around. It's not often. But I've seen too many cases where children are impacted. And in fact, I'll tell you another story if I may.
Yeah.
I had a father come to court with his young son, a 15-year-old boy, who'd been charged with stealing a scarf. And the father walked up. I asked the boy how he pleaded, and before the boy could answer, the father said, "He pleads guilty, Your Honor, and he's ready to take what he's got coming." And I said, "Well, hang on a second. I'd just like to talk to your son for a minute. How do you plead to this?" And he says, "Well, I don't know. I guess I've got to plead guilty." I said, "No, you don't have to plead guilty." I said, "I'll tell you what. We'll adjourn this case for a month, and I'd like you and your father to come back here, and I'd like you, sir, his father, speaking to his father, to tell me what you and your son talked about for the last month." He said, "Well, you can't do that." And I said, "Well, actually, I can do that, and that's what I'm ordering you to do." And if you don't, then we'll think about contempt. He said, oh, okay, okay. So a month later, the father comes back to the son. I said, called the case. I said, tell me, what are you talking about? Well, we haven't talked about anything. I said, okay, I'll see you next month. And then he came back next month, and I said, well, tell me about your conversation. He said, well, we haven't said too much. I mean, I don't know why we have to keep doing this, Judge, really. I mean, we talked a little bit about how he's going to straighten himself out. I said, okay, I'll see you next month. And then finally, the last month, he came back, and I said, tell me what you talked about. He said, you know, we talked about a lot, and he described about how his son was doing and so forth. And he said, you know, I don't think he should go to jail. I think this is a lot more involved than that, and I've really gotten to know him and so forth. And I said, this case is now adjourned in contemplation dismissal. I'm glad you found your son.
That's an awesome story. In the book, you have two main characters, Johan and Preston Wilson. Why the two main characters? It's almost to a point to me when I was reading the book, it gives you the yin and the yang, so to speak, initially. So tell us about that.
Well, the characters, Joe and Preston, are so different. I mean, Joe grew up as an orphan, no mom and dad. They were killed when he was 10, brought up by his uncle and his aunt in the wilderness, rural, poor. All he worried about was being an average guy, and he wanted to not be average. But he came from that world. Preston, on the other hand, an elitist, Upper East Side, New York City, out of family of wealth. He feared being a failure as his father had been. These two men of such different worlds, and then when one needs the help of the other, it sets up the story for what happens when a man reaches out to another man and desperately needs help, and the other man says, well, I'll give you the help, but conditioned on your fulfilling a condition in the future unspecified. How did Preston live with that? How can he do that? And so when the time comes that IOU is called in, Preston has to seek out and earn the trust of and care for six collectibles of Joe, so-called, none of whom Preston would ever want to know. These are not the kind of people he'd want to ever be with. And yet they have, while challenged, intrinsic worth. And so that dynamic, is, as you know, reading the book, goes through how Preston changes. The other point I would make is that apart from Joe and Preston, which are the centerpiece or the focal point characters, the real characters in the book are the women behind them, because it's those women who really fuel the redemption of the men. And that, I think, is an accurate metaphor in life. I think the women are so often the ones that truly get into the core of the issue, know how to listen, and know how to guide themselves and others through situations. It's the impact that the women have on the men in this novel that takes the attention away from Joe and Preston.
Very true. I really like that. I'm glad you mentioned that. The collectibles deal with many of today's social issues, like domestic abuse you had talked about just now, bipolar disorder, developmental disability, Alzheimer's, and gambling. Why did you choose to write about these challenges for the various characters? Is that something very important to you?
Yeah, absolutely it's very important to me. I mean, every one of those issues, I've already talked about domestic abuse and how serious an issue that is. And in the characters, Tommy Greco and Missy, they know a lot about being the victims of abuse and how does that affect their lives. We really need to address that dramatically in our society. So the reason I write about it is because I've counseled and dealt with and tried to help many, many women in that situation, and they need help, and they need help navigating the judicial system as well. In many cases, it's a loaded deck against the women mm-hmm. who were actually the victims. And then, mm-hmm. so that's very real to me. In terms of bipolar disorder, I can't count how many people in my career I've dealt with who have the burden of bipolar or manic depressive or depression itself. That's one of the real sweepers in terms of realization of big issues out there that people have to confront and deal with every day. And they really need help. Just because these characters have flaws and conduct themselves in a flawed way, that doesn't mean they're bad people. Mm-hmm. It's the conduct that may be bad, but that doesn't make the person bad. So if you look at these people and you look at what kind of help they need, bipolar or depression or domestic abuse, developmental disability. The village I grew up in had a state school, it was called in those days, and I became very familiar at an early age with the issues that revolve around what has been called retarded, mentally challenged, whatever mm-hmm. the terms are. The fact is these people were human beings that needed a lot of help and still do. I was involved in a lot of that, and so it was direct involvement that caused the interest. Alzheimer's, very real to me. I know people with Alzheimer's, have had Alzheimer's. It's a terrible, terrible disease. Mm-hmm. It not only robs people of their memory ultimately and their lives, but their dignity. And it's very hard on the caregivers. Gambling is always been of interest to me, and it's an addiction. But it's also fun if it managed to be controlled. So how do you deal with all that? I guess the point, Johnny, is to me is that the characters have disabilities, they have challenges, but they have to meet those disabilities and they have to meet those challenges. We've all had those challenges in life. I've had them myself. I know what disability means. For example, quite frankly, when I was in law school, I found out at the end of my first year that I was missing certain things. I got very high grades in several subjects, but then there were a couple subjects that I didn't get good grades in. And the dean of the law school called me in and said, how come you get A's in the torts and contracts and criminal law and then civil procedure you get a D in there? Don't you like that? Or you just want to pick and choose what classes you like? What's the matter with you? And I said, I think the problem is that I'm missing something. Well, I found out that what I was missing is hearing. Mm-hmm. And I was examined by a hearing doctor for the first time in my life. And this was in law school. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I wasn't hearing. And I was fortunate enough to go through high school with good grades, go through college. It was a wonderful experience. I didn't know that I was missing anything. But I found out that in law school, the two courses that didn't have casebooks and were taught by a professor with his back to me looking at the blackboard, stadium seating in those days, mm-hmm. I wasn't getting what he was saying or she was saying. So that was the first real crisis in my life. Up until then, the stuff I had worked on and done came easy to me, and it was just wonderful, wonderful experience. Mm-hmm. College, everything went well. I loved the courses. I loved it all. And I loved law and law mm-hmm. school. But I had a problem that I had to deal with. Well, this was in the early 60s, Johnny, and I can mm-hmm. tell you that law schools at that time didn't want anybody that was disabled. If you mm-hmm. were in a wheelchair or had a hearing problem or you were a woman for that matter, you mm-hmm. weren't welcome then. It's a sad period of history in our law schools. The law schools wanted everybody to be look good and act good and not have a disability. Well, anyway, I was fitted for hearing aids and learned to work with that world. And it was interesting. I could hear the janitor whistling on the third floor, but I had trouble hearing the person in front of me. Those hearing aids were pretty rough in those days. But in any event, I went back to law school and did just fine after that, and it was actually a lot easier hearing. I didn't realize what an advantage people had when they could actually hear everything that was said. But it was a real learning experience for me. And I was advised by my law professor, my guidance professor, not to go into law. I said, you've got a hearing problem. You should just go into government or work someplace else.
Yeah.
I said, well, I don't want to do that. And I want to be a trial lawyer. And he said, well, you've got to face reality. You're in denial. You can't be a trial lawyer if you have a hearing problem. How can you be a lawyer with a hearing problem?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know how, but I'm going to find out how. Well, anyway, years later, I worked with a lawyer in New York City on a case in the Bronx, 1981, I think it was. And together we got the largest wrongful death verdict at that time in the history of New York State. I was invited back to my law school to lecture the torts class on the verdict. When I walked in, I saw that same professor sitting in the same office. I stopped in and I said, how are you doing? He said, fine. And what are you here for? And I told him. He said, oh, yeah, I read about that. That's really interesting. And I said, well, I just want to mention to you that you probably don't remember me. He said, no. And I said, well, I'm the fellow you told to not become a lawyer. And I just hope that when you talk to young guys, or men and women today, and they tell you what their dreams are and what they might like to do, instead of telling them why they can't, try to figure out how they can. So
I agree very, very much.
I will just say that I actually had a wonderful career in law, and people were patient with me. I made sure that I heard what I needed to hear, even if it meant getting closer to the witness, or I just gave away any embarrassment. I just said to people then and now, I'm sorry, I'm hard of hearing. I need you to speak a little slower, and I'll try to listen a little harder. But the last point I'll make about hearing, Johnny, is that the real question is how actively we hear, because listening is more important than hearing and not listening.
Right. What I gather from what you have just said, what's interesting to me is that when you overcome fear, you can pretty much do everything. And to me, Jim, what has happened in a way, things happen for a reason. And the fact that you finally realize that you do have a hearing problem, it probably humbled you at that time and made you focus on things that are more important, and actually probably made you a better attorney because you are intuitively listening to every word that's said, rather than just zipping right through and just can't wait to kind of get your side of the story out. And I think this is a tremendous strength for you. And not only that, giving you the opportunity now, in your book, for example, you talk about all the different social issues that we are currently facing. It's real life, real situation, real people. And you expertly weave the story of real life, real situation into this wonderful novel. And I think that's the strength of the entire novel itself. It's the story behind the story. It's the message behind the message. So that's totally wonderful.
Well, thank you for that. And I appreciate it.
What are your favorite characters in the book?
Well, Johnny's not a bad... I mean, Joe's not a bad guy. I think I don't have any favorites in the book, and I'll tell you why I say that. They're all my favorites.
Yeah.
And the reason they're all my favorites is because each of these characters, the men and the women, they have a particular side that I wanted to examine in development of those characters. People are not—they're not black and white. They're not good or bad. They're a little of both. And the question is, how can we look at someone and try to find the bright spots? How can we bring that side of the person out? And in these characters, they impact each other in memorable ways. I mean, I like the character of Joe. I'd like to be like a character like Joe. But at the same time, I can really appreciate Preston because of the transformation he had to make and the challenges he had to face. I love Corey. I love the dignity of the man. I loved Johnny and what he went through, and I knew people like Johnny, and you can really love these people. Harry and I won't go through each character. Missy is a phenomenal character. I really, they're all my favorite because they each have some point of intrinsic value, as I said earlier, just intrinsic worth. And to me, the question is, how can we find that worth in individuals? And that's what makes these characters come alive for me, is they have that challenge, and they go about doing it.
Fantastic. What is the message you would like your readers to take away from reading your novel?
Well, I think the real message is that we have to figure out how we can do what we can do on an individual basis to find the worth in every individual and the value in making that effort to find it. We can adjust the lens we look through, sometimes clean it if necessary. But in doing so, we need to see how we can help one another and in the process help ourselves. That's the message I think is in the book.
Very true. This novel is for your wife, Patty, and also you have dedicated it to a couple of people you admire very much. Please share with us about these special friendships and relationships.
Well, I'd need about 3 hours to talk about my wife, Patty. Let me just say that at the core of my existence is my wife. We've been married 44 years. I remain hopelessly in love with her. And I believe that she has been such a wonderful wife to me and such a wonderful mother to our children and such a wonderful friend to everybody that knows her. I just find her a person I trust, a person I respect, obviously a person I love, and a friend I really need. So that's all I can say about my wife.
That's why you guys are married for 44 years and
40,
going.
That's right. And as far as the dedication to the book, I dedicated the book to my dad. I've talked a lot about him. He was an old-fashioned doctor. He cared about his patients. He was a wonderful father. He was a wonderful friend. And so I dedicated the book to him. When I was writing this book, and my mom was still alive, I mentioned to her that I was writing a book and I wanted to dedicate it to her. And she said, why don't you dedicate it to your father, and after you get it done right, then you'll dedicate the next one to me. So, anyway, I'll do that on the next book. But as far as the other dedication was to a family, my doctor in Wilmington, who's no longer with us, but he was a neighbor and a friend, and he too was an old-fashioned doctor, and that's why I included him in the dedication.
Very interesting. And you don't have that many doctors that are like that anymore,
unfortunately. Boy, you sure don't. And nurses as well. In fact, I think the nurses are the ones today carrying the banner of medicine because they're relating to the patients on the front line, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. My heart wishes that there were more old-fashioned doctors like my dad.
How has writing The Collectibles impacted you personally?
Well, it's been a wonderful experience. It's been a learning experience. It was hard work. I think the thing that I love about it is that once it's finally done, which now it is in terms of the writing, it gives me an opportunity to have discussions like this. And if it's a vehicle for these kind of discussions, and if it's a vehicle for reaching out and understanding the development of relationships, then I think it was really worthwhile. Other than that, I'm really happy that I got this done. I mean, it was something I'd wanted to do for a long, long time. It took a long time for me to do it, and I'm glad I finally did it. And I'd like to move on to the next one, but I sure do think it had a positive impact on me personally. I mean, you live these characters, you think about them in the shower, you think about them at 3 a.m. It's a real immersion in the whole idea and thought process that goes into this thing.
So
it's had an impact on me personally, but it's been a wonderful experience.
Where does The Collectible rank in your collection of memorable experiences?
Well, for me, it's actually right at the top because I had a dream of being a traveler, and I accomplished the dream. I had a dream of doing a lot of other things, and I won't go through them all, but I've accomplished those dreams. And I think having dreams is really important to people. Mm-hmm. And I would really ask anybody that has a dream to chase that dream and make it happen. But when I got to the point I did it in my life, and I finally decided I would stop practicing law because I'd been blessed to get as far as I had with my hearing. I went through my career. But I stopped practicing law because I was afraid I was going to miss something in hearing. And I was afraid if I missed something, I wouldn't be doing all I could be doing for my client. But that was a tough decision to walk away. No one asked me to, and nobody complained about what I had been doing. But when I did walk away, and I then retired for about 30 days, I got a phone call from a yacht distributor asking me to help them with the yachting business in America.
Mm-hmm.
And during that period, I gave myself permission to finally address the writing I had so long wanted to do. And that's when I started really writing this book. And so, you know, to have it completed and to overcome the challenges associated with it, it's in terms of where does it rank? Honestly, Johnny, right at the top. Pretty exciting for me because I just like I felt when I walked by that law firm directory when I was 26 years old and couldn't quite believe my name would still be there. I never really thought I'd have gotten to the point where I'd finished a novel, but I have, and I'm pleased about it. It's a big thing for me.
I can see a lot of you in the novel in terms of your passion, your spirituality, and what you believe. And that's the wonderful thing of having you on the air with me this morning. Where can someone buy your book and get more information about you and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, they can buy the book today from Two Sisters Bookery, which is at 318 Nutt Street in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful bookstore there. They can call there at 910-762-4444 or email them at angela2sistersbookery.com or go to their website at 2sistersbookery.com. The other thing they can do is visit my website at jamesjkaufman.com, which I would love to have your listeners do because I'd like to hear from them, and I'd love to know who are the collectibles in their lives and did any of this make sense to them. They could buy the book that way. They could find the book that way. And I'd certainly love to hear from them.
Well, what can we expect from you in 2011?
Well, I'm working on a screenplay for this book, and I'm also working and well underway with a new novel. And also, if the readers of this book truly like this book, which I hope is the case, then I have a sequel in mind to that.
By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Yes. For me, it starts with a philosophy, an approach to life. I guess Socrates had it right. First, know thyself. Mm-hmm. Then I would say carve out your dreams, whatever they are, and don't let anybody tell you what you can't do. Concentrate on what you can do, and don't quit at that. I would suggest doing a lot of thinking about the meaning of life and the choices and decisions we all must make. How does what we choose to do or not to do affect ourselves and others? I believe it's important to look, to listen, try to understand what we see and what we hear. It takes time and effort and caring to really look, to make sure our lens is clear, to actively listen, so we can truly hear what's being said or not said. And only then can we try to understand. So looking outward, as contrasted with paying too much attention to ourselves, is a big help. Not thinking less of ourselves, but thinking of ourselves less, I guess. I once asked an old farmer why he never complained and seemed content. He said, "Well, young fella, when you got to take care of the horses and the cows and the chickens and the garden and everything else, there ain't a lot of time to worry about yourself." I watched my dad work 14 hours a day caring for patients. The only time I ever saw him unhappy was when he wasn't doing that. So we're all essentially in the same boat. We all need help. We need to determine what we can do to help one another and in the process help ourselves. There are no long-term leases on life as I see it. No automatic renewals, no certainty in how long we'll have the God-given blessing of life. I believe, Johnny, we should regard each day as a gift, an opportunity to achieve our purpose, to receive the most meaning out of life we can. That starts, I guess, with being honest with ourselves, capable of trust, caring out, and reaching out to others, and being thankful for the support our loved ones give us. Relationships matter. As far as I'm concerned, it's not about control or money or power, but it's about extensions from the heart. And that's my recipe.
It's fantastic. It's really, really wonderful. Jim, thank you for the great recipes. I know that you do a lot of charity work based on just hearing what you have mentioned just now in your recipe for life. And based on what you have done, I mean, just hearing you as a person who is very humble and very spiritual, tell us some of the charities that you're involved with.
Well, the one that I'm most excited about is called Imaging the World. This is a not-for-profit company in which a wonderful doctor named Christian De Stichter has founded, co-founded, and gone to Uganda and treating pregnant mothers mm-hmm. who would otherwise, 25% of whom would otherwise die at childbirth. And what they've done is created a portable ultrasound meter level analyzer and training people locally, lay people, to administer the ultrasound to find the defect and then have the film sent back to the radiological reading centers and have the diagnostic made and then arrange for the surgery, repair the pregnant woman's problem, and she can deliver childbirth without the death of the baby and harm to herself. So to me, that's one charity that one effort that it has a direct line between what they're doing and the good that comes from it. You don't mm-hmm. have to worry about whether it all gets lost somewhere between the donation and the effect. It really moves me, and I volunteered my service to work on their board, and I'm supportive of Dr. Braff and Dr. De Stichter and all the others that have done so much with that company, Imaging the World. And that's probably the top of the list of my own favorite charities.
Now, I know you work a lot internationally with different companies and different firms all over the world. Tell us some of that involvement that you have and how you are able to transform some of their thought process as well.
Well, one of the most interesting parts about my international work was started, and I tell you this because it starts with the idea that if you reach out to help somebody without any thought of return, what can mm-hmm. come of it? I taught my son to scuba dive when he was 10 years old, and we used to travel all over the place scuba diving every year for 25 or more years. And one of those trips, we were in some island near in the west side of South America, Bonaire or something, and we went to dive in a dive boat, and there was a man there who we didn't know, and he was all by himself, and he seemed like he could use a buddy, so we invited him to dive with us. And as you mm-hmm. know, scuba diving, especially advanced diving, you want to make sure that you've got somebody that can, you know, do what they need to do down there with you. Anyway, we mm-hmm. invited him. His name was Sandy, I invited him to dive with us each day. We dove together for about four straight days, and we chatted a lot, but I never asked him any questions about what he did, or I didn't want mm-hmm. to. He was there on mm-hmm. vacation. It was a pleasure to have him with us. Mm-hmm. Well, the last day of diving, he said to me, "Well, what are you going to do now?" And I said, "Well, I'm kind of excited because I've been invited to go to China by the government, and the Attorney General is one of 200 lawyers in America, to attend the first Sino-American Conference on Economics and Law, and I'm going there with my wife, and then I'm going to stay for that conference, and I'm just really excited about it." He said, "Well, that sounds interesting. Have a good time." I said, "Thank you." Well, I took Patty to China, and our daughter was going to college, so at that point Patty went back to take Christine to college, and I stayed for the conference. And the first day was at the Hall of the People, great Hall of the People, and it was amazing, like huge church set up in a way with benches and aisles. And at 10:30 we broke for tea, the opening ceremony. As I walked down the aisle, the man I met just as we turned from the other aisle was Sandy. And I said, "Sandy, how you doing? What are you doing here?" He said, "Well, I want to talk to you about that." He took me to the back of the room, and he interrupted the conversation a minute to talk to the one of the prime ministers of China in Mandarin, perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening to all of this, and then he turned to me and he said, "Jim, I've appointed you to be the head of the delegation in this committee, and this is the assignments I've got picked out for you, and I think you're going to really have a wonderful conference." And I couldn't believe it, my ears. When I walked into the room I was assigned to, I went to the back and sat down in one of the chairs, and then the Chinese caring for that session came up and said, "Oh, no, you sit up in the front in this big chair." I sat up there with all these VIPs. I couldn't believe it. But it was a wonderful experience. That was the foundation for starting relationships with the China National Corporation of Medicine. It involved 6 years of business intercourse with China. It led to all kinds of things, all of which came from an extension of kindness to a man with nothing expected in return.
It's a beautiful story. Well, James, thank you for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me in a couple of weeks on Tuesday morning, December the 14th. My guest will be singer and songwriter W.T. Greer. Known as the Nat King Cole of the new generation, Greer has performed for five of our nation's presidents and first ladies. He also had a rare opportunity to perform privately for Oprah Winfrey. W.T. and I will be discussing about his life's journey this Christmas and the power of unconditional love. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Twitter/FMMKTalkRadio. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Jim, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you very much, Jenny.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.